Hello and welcome to episode 281 of the Modest Wavelength podcast. I'm your host, Wei Shen, and this week I brought on Val Wotton from the DTCC to talk about how firms are preparing for the move to US T+1. But before we get to that, I have Theo here as my co-host this week. Hey, Theo, how's it going?
Hey, Wei Shen, how are you?
I'm good, good. You've written a couple of stories about dark pools recently. Do you want to tell the audience how those stories came about?
Yeah, sure. It started off with an announcement by Euronext, which is a large European exchange, that they were going to start allowing dark trading on their Belgian listed stocks, which began last week, and then that they were going to roll out the rest of their listed markets onto dark trading in April. I had a chat with a representative of Euronext who told me a bit more about that project. And in the process of reporting on that, a couple of sources mentioned that Deutsche Börse might be planning something similar. And once a few of them had said that to me, I got to put it to Deutsche Börse, and the news broke. It was a really interesting story from my perspective. I didn't know much about dark trading. It seems like one of those kind of shadowy, slightly obscure aspects of markets, which not too many people know about, but seems to have quite a big impact on market structure.
And we're really proud that you broke that story. So kudos to you, man. I totally agree with you that dark trading is, I guess it's in its name, right? It's just maybe not many people would know much about it, especially those who are, I guess, trading on the lit market. As a journalist, I guess, like, looking into this topic, it's interesting and it's wonky. I guess for you, what was the most interesting thing that you got out, in your research and in, producing those stories?
Well, I'll say two things. One is a slightly obscure but funny quirk of the processual nature of European lawmaking, which is, I found out that during the MiFID II review and the MiFIR review, which is coming in about a week or less, I believe, there was a kind of oversight in the European lawmaking process, and that the dark trading caps, which are being liberalised, were entirely phased out for 18 months unintentionally. Idea was that they were going to go from a double volume cap, which would mean that the aggregate level of dark trading which could happen across European venues was capped at 8%, and that the amount that could happen on any given volume was capped at a lower percentage. I think it's 4. And that they were going to replace that with a single volume cap of 7% in aggregate across all European venues. But they neglected to put in any cap for the intervening period between the double volume cap being phased out and the new one being brought in 18 months from now. So, who knows what will happen with that? I believe that lawmakers are trying to patch it and sort of put an addendum onto the next piece of regulation which comes through the lawmaking process, which says, by the way, there will be a sort of intermediary cap in the meantime. But it'll be really interesting to see what happens with that. And if there is no cap on the amount of dark trading that can take place in Europe for the next, 18 months, what will volumes be like? I imagine they'll shoot up. But that probably won't happen. Anyway, that's more of a kind of funny quirk of the system. I think more broadly, the most interesting thing I learned from it was just how much volumes of unlit trading are rising. That doesn't just mean dark trading. It includes things like, periodic auction and block trading and anything where there's a waiver, which means that you don't need to disclose before the trade the fact that you're in the market for a given stock. But I hadn't realized that there was quite such pressure on lit trading, which now represents less than 50% of the overall trading volumes in Europe. That seems like a story quite a big story in the making. And it'll be interesting to see how that progresses, how market participants try and find new ways to execute trades without allowing information to get out before the trade is actually executed.
And yeah, we'll maybe bring you on again in the near future when you put out another story related to this topic. Thank you so much for stepping in as my co-host this week. Let's get to my interview with Val. Till next time.
Thanks, Michelle. Bye.
All right. Joining me today is Val Wharton, Managing Director and General Manager for Institutional Trade Processing at the DTCC. Hey, Val, how are you doing?
Hey, Wei-Shen. Very good. Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Well, just for the benefit of our audience here, why don't you give us a little bit of background about yourself and what you're doing at DTCC?
Will do. So, I've been DTCC for 7 years, as you said, running our institutional trade processing business. The core products that we have within that are our CTM that does all of the block and allocation matching. And then as the broader world is now becoming aware of, Trade Suite that does the affirmation process, which I'm sure we'll talk about here too. Additionally, we're also the custodians of Alert, which has over 15 million standard settlement instructions across both securities, cash and collateral as well. Those are sort of the key products that we have, and I'm sure we'll touch on those as we go through the podcast today.
Great. And as we record this podcast, there is now 61 days left to US T+1, which is happening on the 28th of May, 2024. That leaves us pretty much with, I guess, 2 months. And if we're taking the weekends out, that's even less, right? How do you feel about that?
Joe, I think we're getting to the point now where I think we just need to go live, Wei-Shen. I think there's been a lot of, a lot of discussion, a lot of talk, a lot of preparation that's gone in. If we take a step back, this has been years in the making. DCC with SIFMA and the SEC have worked, collectively and tirelessly around issuing documentation, run books, testing plans. And so I think where we're really getting to now is, moving away from sort of that testing conversation to operational readiness, if that makes sense. I know there's been lots of different surveys that have taken place. I think from having spent 2 weeks out in Asia specifically, firms are very aware of the move to the US moving to T1. I think there is now a very clear understanding of some of the challenges that presents and how they need to solve for those, whether that's around the affirmation cutoff, for example, whether it's around, how do they manage FX funding, process improvements potentially around stock lending as well. And so I think now it's really a case of that, with the finish line in sight, I think minds are really focused, and really it's a case of now readiness rather than testing. And as I say, I think for everyone, it's a case of then just sort of looking to go live. I'm sure there'll be some bumps in the road, but this industry is very good at solving for those. And collectively we'll work together as an industry to manage through those. But I think a lot of the preparation has been done, a lot of the talking's been done. I think we're getting to the point now where it's a case of, that old saying, the rubber hits the road, right? And it's time to go live and work through what that new environment will look like.
Right. Now there are a lot of parts to think about, firms need to think about when they are preparing for T1. You mentioned, moving out of the testing phase to getting operationally ready. And I know that the DTCC has just on March 25th, actually released a statement on firms' readiness. Could you walk through the progress and the findings that you found there?
So if I just take a step back for the audience, so at the back end of January, we published a review or report on the overall status of affirmation across the industry. We thought it was important just to, put a stake in the ground for us then to measure improvement on a go-forward basis. And then every month post that, we then publish further metrics around the overall level of affirmation rates across the industry. And so, on the positive side is that we are seeing progress around the overall affirmation rates themselves. So we're up to now 74.5% of all transactions are being affirmed by 9 p.m. On Eastern Standard Time on trade date. That's sort of a 10% increase versus where we were six to 12 months ago. So we are seeing some traction. The one thing I'd call out is that what we try to break out within the report itself, Weishen, is the sort of two key buckets. So what we see is that close to two thirds of all the institutional flow that comes through CTM and Trade Suite is very much going into the clearing workflow. So what we'd call NSCC, and it goes through the clear process. So that's very much prime broker and hedge fund volume. And what we see there is that has a far higher affirmation rate. That's up at sort of 83% by 9 p.m. And actually, I'm very confident that we'll get that up to about probably in the region of about 95%. There's a couple of prime brokers that are just working through moving from sort of batch affirmation to real-time affirmation. And those projects are in flight. We have good visibility of that. And we expect that sort of through the April timeframe to all be set up and ready to go. So that would very much align itself to what the current metrics are in a T2 world. So in a T2 world today, an 11:30 T plus one Eastern Standard Time, the PB volume is 95% is affirmed by that cutoff. So that's the first package. So I think two thirds, actually, I think we're going to be in a good space with. So then we turn our attention to the other third of the population, which is what is the bilateral settlement. So the non-cleared flow, which goes through DTC. And I think that's where what we've really called out is sort of a number of segments, I think is probably the best way of describing it. So what we see is that where firms are using auto-affirmation and what we've called our match to instruct workflow, whereby the broker dealer and the investment manager confirm both the block and allocations in CTM and switch on the auto-affirmation and match to instruct workflow, which automates that affirmation process through Trade Suite down into DTC, we're seeing very high rates. Where it's fully automated, it's up at close to 100% by 9 p.m. Where there's still some automation to follow, it's still up in the high 80, it's about 89%, 92% kind of range as well. So we're seeing where clients look to use straight through processing and actually automating their workflow, getting good rates of affirmation rates. The challenge really presents itself in sort of the segment that we call out, which is where a custodian or investment manager is then sort of affirming. And so an investment manager really has three options. One, they can look, if they're live on CTM, to switch on the auto-affirmation process. Two, they can choose to self-affirm themselves, or they can request that their custodian or prime broker, but in this case, their custodian affirms on their behalf. And so that's the population where we are seeing some progress, but it's still in the region of 53%. And to give you a kind of idea, in a T2 environment, again, 11:30 on T1 Eastern Standard Time, that's generally up at around 78 to 80% of transactions are affirmed. So that's the population, that sort of third within the DCC group that we really are trying to focus on and partnering very closely with the IMs and also, so the investment managers and the custodians globally. And I think on that population, I think what we really see there is where sort of the global footprint plays in slightly more. So I think where you then had this 9 p.m. cutoff, what we're seeing is that that's where potentially operationally there's certain challenges that play out around how do firms position themselves to support that. So if I take a step back, I'd probably say that, you know, large global investment managers that have sort of follow the sun operational model and book, it's less of a concern for, because they can pass the baton from one time zone to another. And this is very much around, you know, if there are any exceptions or queries on a transaction, who's going to solve for that, right? And they've then probably also would pass the book from a trading desk perspective as well. You know, if there was any, you know, say there's a discrepancy on price or commission, for example, somebody has to opine on that. The challenge I think you see when you get into Asia and Europe is obviously from a time zone perspective, if those issues present themselves later in the US day, which obviously is very much from an Asia perspective, you know, morning time, how are they setting themselves up to solve for that? And so what's been interesting over the last couple of weeks, and I feel very fortunate to spend so much time with clients, is that it's very much around looking at operationally, how do they solve for that? So what we're seeing is, from an Australia perspective, probably less of a concern. The time zone probably works for them, apart from, you know, say sort of a Saturday morning, so end of day Friday and a public holiday. But generally speaking, they'll have coverage time zone wise to deal with those queries. I think what's interesting around sort of more Hong Kong, Singapore time zone wise, you know, is do local IMs need to consider starting an earlier shift, you know, where they don't have a global footprint, they need to get staff in at, say, 6-7 o'clock in the morning. Also, will custodians look at how they extend their cutoff? So if there are any exceptions that need to be worked through, can they solve for those? Again, the interesting piece there is what happens on a Saturday morning for close of business Friday, and again, public holidays. And then as you move into Europe as well, obviously that becomes even more of a challenge, probably more so than Asia, given that actually the time zone doesn't work. And so how do they then solve for if there are queries from an affirmation perspective? So hopefully that gives us sort of an overview of breaking down sort of the segments that we have within the report, and then where the sort of the more specific areas of challenge are, and how that also on a regional basis plays out as well.
So am I right by saying that affirmations actually is the biggest challenge in the entire trade life cycle, where firms are, I guess, maybe falling behind at this moment? Or is there another area that, you know, you think should be highlighted?
So I think from conversations, Weishen, that I think obviously affirmations is one of those. The one clarifying point I'll make around the affirmation process is that if you miss the 9 p.m. cutoff, which is obviously the optimal way of submitting the transaction into DCC and staging it for settlement, you know, there are other mechanisms. There's the delivery order process whereby you can still submit a settlement instruction into DCC for settlement. It's just less efficient and more costly than hitting the 9 p.m. cutoff. So I think it's a really important clarification for the audience to be aware of. There has been some interesting articles in the press where I think they've tried to associate unaffirmed equals fails. That's not how the US market works. Very much, you know, it's a case that you stage it for settlement, and outside of the automated flow, there is this process called the delivery order process, whereby you can still submit into DTC. And in the US market, you can submit into both a night cycle or a day cycle as well. So it's not just one cycle and that you fail. So just one point of clarification. I think if you step away from the affirmation perspective and zoom out, I think what we, you know, what I've heard loud and clear, and again, we can see more broadly, is probably, you know, FX funding is probably the other area of focus for investment managers, and how do they solve for that specific challenge itself, given the time zone and also the shortening cycle from a T1 perspective. So that would probably be the other area I would probably call out specifically.
Okay, I've been talking to obviously a lot of different sources, right, about T+1, and obviously seeing the impact for Asia, for firms out in Asia as well in Europe, and I like how one person actually described it. He said that, well, 9 p.m. New York or 9 p.m. Eastern is basically the new sun, and everyone just needs to align their schedules to that sun. Do you feel the same way?
I think fundamentally, if you're transacting US securities, the reality is that you have to factor that in. And I think that then means that firms then have to think about how do they operationally support that in an accelerated timeline. I think the interesting thing there, Weishen, is that, you know, given, you know, that Europe and the UK and Switzerland are going to look to move to T1 at some point in time, you know, there's also discussions in Asia around Asian markets that are, you know, potentially looking at T1 as well. I think potentially, you know, that sun, depending on where you are for what markets, will obviously move. And I think what it really means is that if you're looking to transact in those markets, the real question is how do you then support that, and what decisions do you make around that footprint? So I think it's, yeah, I mean, it's all dependent on the market that you trade in. But I get the statement from a US market perspective that you sort of have to use that as your guiding point to then ensure that how you're set up to support it works through. And obviously that then presents challenges around how do you provide the right operational staff, front office staff from a time zone perspective. But it feels like we're turning into sort of a 24/5 or 6 operating model now as we do contract that accelerated settlement cycles across the globe, right?
Okay. Yep. Okay. So the SEC is adopting Rule 15C 6-2, right, to facilitate trade date completion of trade allocations, confirmations, and affirmations, which actually puts the onus on broker dealers to take certain actions so that 100% of trades are affirmed as soon as technologically practicable. Where So you just published that state of readiness, right? And how are we going to get to that 100%? And what are some of the actions that broker dealers, and I guess hence their clients, the investment managers, what do they need to take to, you know, try and hit that target? And I guess a follow-up question to that is, like, how stringent is the SEC going to be on that?
I think great questions, right? I think the question around stringent from an SEC perspective is my expectation extremely. The SEC does not set rules and expect them to be anything but met. So I think the rules are very clearly defined, and the expectation of the SEC is that that we'll hit 100% with regards to that confirmation, allocation, affirmation, timeliness perspective. And I think the interesting piece there is that the mechanism that the SEC uses is that they look to then examine the firms that they regulate, and they go in, and off the back of that, potentially dependent on how they're performing, they then have within their sort of tool set, ability to then penalize firms itself. So I think the really important thing is that for nobody to underestimate nobody to really underestimate the severity of what it means to have to comply with the US regulations. And so for the audience perspective, it's extremely important that that's understood. So I think from a broker dealer perspective, obviously what they're looking to do at this moment in time is create those policies and procedures and all the reporting that will be required to be able to evidence that they're doing everything within their power to drive towards 100% rate. And so from your question specifically, I think, if anything, this is all around how do you drive STP and automation. If anything, Rhishen, and I know that you've covered this space for a period of time, right? The issue is that from a securities perspective, there's probably been a lack of investment in the post-trade ecosystem. Yeah. And there's been a lot of focus historically, given post financial crisis on derivatives and obviously a huge amount of investment in that space, and probably securities, maybe less so. In a T2 environment, potentially you can sort of work your way through with more manual processing to comply. I think what this does from a T1 perspective is really focus people's minds on the need to drive for automation. Yeah, I think, the SEC's rule that you sort of referenced, again, as soon as technology practical, really plays into that point, which is around how you drive automation STP within the market itself. And so I think, from our perspective, that's where we're looking at bringing solutions to market to support the industry. As I referenced at the top, that's very much around how do we support the ability to drive auto-affirmation and sort of our match-to-instruct workflow. So is that once the block and allocation is agreed, the affirmation happens automatically and we get the transaction into DCC and stage it for settlement as quickly as possible. And so I think there's going to be very much a continued drive around how do we mobilize firms onto that workflow itself, and ensuring that all broker IM pairings are sort of live with that, because it really does remove hops in the process, right? And I think that's what everyone needs to do. The second piece is how do we try and complete the allocation process as timely as possible? We sort of issued a best practice, which is that allocation should be completed by 7 p.m. ET. So that gives you a 2-hour window to address any potential breaks that you may have. The reality there is that, that's on the basis of seeing a lot of allocations happening post US close. But if you know how you're going to allocate, and you have standard models, how do you ensure you do that as soon as possible? Can we move more towards a model of that, you issue the block and you allocate immediately if you know how you're going to allocate more broadly? So I think, there's practical changes, there's technological changes as well. When we think about it, I sort of referenced alert as well. We're very fortunate, over 15 million SSIs, 3 million cash SSIs. Well, again, how do you make sure that those SSIs are stored within alert, that we're enriching within the processes, again, to minimize the chance of a break or a fail as well. So I think the bottom line is that, with any kind of contracting of time frame, the only way to really solve for it is technology. In the short term, yes, you can throw bodies at it, but is that sustainable yep. over the longer term? And so I think, you know, there's a very clear direction being laid out here. So it's just a case of, it'll be over a period of time, but I'm hoping, you know, for somebody who spent 18 years running post-trade processing on the bank side, you know, I think anything that can help get firms' investment into the post-trade world where you can drive efficiency has got to be a good thing. So I think I don't know if that answers your question fully, but just probably my perspective.
Okay. But I'm curious, will there be any consequences from this rule? Because since the onus is on the broker dealers, right? I mean, what are some potential consequences for the IMs, you know, that are dealing that deal with the broker dealers? Are there some things that the broker dealers might try to put more pressure on the IMs to basically get all their allocations and confirmations and affirmations done at a timely, in a timely manner?
So I think it's going to be interesting to see what the broker dealers put in their policies and procedures and what approach they look to take around those IMs that aren't necessarily complying. I think obviously they're going to need to be very thoughtful to ensure that they are complying themselves, right? That they're doing all their processing as efficiently as possible, that they're maximizing automation as efficiently as possible as well. Yeah, I think what's very clear in the first stage, it feels like there will be a lot of reporting to present analysis around those that aren't affirming within a timeline, and then obviously all of the data to ascertain as to why that's the case. And we've been helping the industry with that. We've built out a T+1 scorecard, which gives an overview of overall affirmation rates and the ability for clients to drill down into that to understand where there may be challenges and how they can resolve for those. Over the longer term, Wei Shen, I think it'd be very interesting to see how that plays out. I think historically, obviously, IMs have probably named and shamed their broker dealers or ranked their broker dealers from a performance perspective. Mm. I think the interesting piece here is that IMs are probably going to see a similar kind of approach now in relation to where they are versus their peer groups as well. So I think that'll be interesting on that piece. Outside of that, I think the other component will also be, as I sort of referenced before with regards to the delivery order process, if you're not hitting the affirmation timeframe, there is additional cost that will be incurred. And so the question will then be is what happens around that? Will that be passed back? Will custodians pass that back to the underlying IMs? Still to be seen whether that does or does not happen as well. So I think there'll be a financial cost associated as well that I think will need to be factored in too. And then for those that are actually a registered investment advisor, what they'll have to think very carefully about, again, where they're regulated by the SEC, is they also have record keeping requirements where they have to evidence that they are completing, you know, the confirmation, allocation and affirmation, including all the associated timestamps with that as well. So I think probably the point to stress is that a lot of focus has been on the broker dealer requirements under the rules, but there's very clear requirements from a registered investment advisor too. And even then, from an institutional trade processing perspective, CTM and TradeSuite, essentially this is the central matching products that we have, we become designated a central matching service provider, CMSP, and we then also have obligations and policies and procedures we have to put in place. A requirement, very clear requirements actually, around that we will have to produce an annual report and the overall level of STP and automation when it comes down to the affirmation process as well, which will then be, you know, public, you know, be public, publicly visible as well. So I think that the key point for me is that no, there are no penalties, as in the sense of from an Asia perspective around mandatory buy-ins, for example, or what happens in Europe with CSDR. However, when you look at both the requirements that are placed on the broker dealers, the requirements that are processed on the British investment advisors, in reality, the requirements are then placed on us as a central matching service provider, and then the cost associated to both from a processing perspective, if there was an increase in delivery order processing, from an efficiency perspective, but also then the actual financial cost. It is sense. It's more in the sense, but that builds up over time, Wei Shen. So I think in totality, there are a number of levers that will need to be factored into that will put additional focus on the industry around ensuring that they are adhering as best as possible. And again, back to what we talked about, the solution to this is that there is tools and technology available today to be able to facilitate ensuring that you can affirm by 9 p.m. So it's a rallying call. You use them, right? They're out there. Let's leverage them and use them as efficiently as possible. And so what you'll also see from us is that we'll be doing a further sort of roadshow and partnering with the custodians around really focus on domestic IMs around how not only do they get a trade suite ID so they can actually see their overall level of affirmation rates, but actually how can they actually maybe move away from custodian affirming to then auto affirmation. So again, they're doing everything possible in their position to try and drive that STP in partnership with their broker dealers and custodians as well.
Okay. That's really interesting. And I guess we'll see come May 28th how it'll all work out. I would imagine that obviously, as you mentioned, that there are going to be some bumps in the road, and it'll be interesting to see how firms, like both on the broker dealer, the IM, as well as the custodian side, what they take to do to smooth those bumps out and put in perhaps a longer term solution, right? Instead of throwing bodies at it, perhaps as a short term solution if they do not already have a plan in place. Okay. I guess it's the last question here. And you referenced this earlier. You said that Europe basically has said that T1 is not an if but a when, right? How do you see the move to T1 taking place given that region's fragmentation? It's 27 block, right? And then to add to that, what about Asia? I know that India is already there, but other markets in Asia, it's also very fragmented space here. So just wondering, when you're speaking to clients or to participants in the industry, what you see kind of happening there? How do you see that move taking place?
Yeah, no, great question, actually. So I think if I start with Europe, if that's okay, all of the conversations, I'm crossing fingers and toes here, right, have been very positive around the hope that both Europe, the UK and Switzerland will look to coordinate. I think there's a real hope and I think a willingness from what I can tell so far around sort of an implementation date that could align. We know that we're waiting for the UK task force to issue its recommendations. Obviously, ESMA's just published sort of a playback of the submission for them from their call of evidence. And the expectation, obviously, they'll provide a final report to the commission towards the end of the year. So I think from our perspective, I think that's one, sort of watching and seeing where that comes out and sort of what kind of implementation date will sort of apply to that. I think from my perspective, what is very interesting is that the European move actually from an Asia perspective is going to be very significant for those domestic IMs. And what really resonated was that, as we sort of talked through at the start of the podcast, I think from a US perspective, sort of the time zone for Asia just about works, right? Not downplaying the need of having to maybe have to start earlier in the day and then, potential weekend, public holiday working kind of thing. But Europe, the time zone really doesn't work. And, that then will present real challenges for those domestic IMs because the question for them is, do they have to then set up an operational trading base outside of Asia, for example? Do they look at outsourcing? But, outsourcing, is a choice that a firm then has to work through. There's pros and cons associated to that as well. But how do they support that? So I think there's definitely an acknowledgement in Europe and the UK of being aware of the impact that will have on Asia. And I think obviously they'll, a very good lead time. I think also they're looking to wait and see how the US implementation plays out. But I think what they have, and we've been very grateful to be asked to, you know, input into a lot of these things, Wei Shen, is just sort of just that length of time, the fact that we built, you know, in the US a playbook, the industry came together collectively with the trade associations and the regulators, you know, really trying to get it as a smooth glide path as possible. So I think the hope in Europe is that it will be aligned from a timing perspective. And again, I think there's a recognition of the impact that will then have and how do Asian domiciled clients then work through that time zone piece, because it just won't, yeah, it won't work in reality. The challenge that Europe has with the US, Asia will have with Europe, I suppose, is the best way of describing it. From an Asia perspective, I think it's interesting. We know that that in Taiwan, I think, you know, there's some work in progress around potential move to T1 as well. I think we're still waiting to see the output of that. In Australia as well, there's an expectation that potentially ASX will issue a white paper. I think just again, it's just timing around that, whether that's pre or post the implementation in the US. But I think, again, I think everyone's sort of talking about there will be a good period of lead time. And again, what seems to be very positive is that, reflecting on the US approach as well, is how do they do that collectively? Again, in Australia, it was very much a conversation around, you know, some kind of consultation paper, white paper of sorts, looking to seek input as well. So I think the bottom line is that the global markets will all move to more of a T1. You're right calling out India, obviously, with their optional T0 window as well. But I think at this point in time, I think it's more around sort of that alignment from a T1 perspective seems to be the approach that we're looking at. And then timing wise, you know, what is that? Is that in sort of, you know, it feels like it's like an end of 27, 28 kind of window, potentially, we sort of think may be the sort of timeline in Europe to be confirmed, right? You know, probably, yeah, just speculation on my part until we see some of that output. But you would think it'd be in that kind of time zone. Year time zone, if that makes sense, given where we are today and sort of the process that go through. And you would imagine that sort of Asia may be in a similar kind of window as well. But again, many jurisdictions and very different markets around how that plays out as well. I do think there is a case of that people do want to take a step back and observe the US go live over, you know, come May and through 24 as well. And I think there's obviously lessons that can be leveraged for any further implementation as well.
Yeah, I guess that will, I mean, come May 28th, 2024, which is, again, in 61 days' time, as we record this. I mean, by then they would have that, I guess, that guide, right? And firms out here, as well as in Europe, would benefit from, you know, seeing how that implementation happened. And as you mentioned, there will be a good enough lead time to, you know, when these jurisdictions actually want to get onto T1. It'll definitely be interesting to see. And perhaps at a later date, post May 28, we can get you back on and do a kind of a post-mortem.
sounds good to me. Fingers crossed. I look forward to it.
Well, Val, it's been a real pleasure having you on. Thank you for taking the time to speak with me today.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you for the time as well.